Nice to see you. Nice. Welcome to the Golden Talkies. We are back on your delicious ears and into your lug holes on this, the last week of February. Our film this week is The Music Lovers, released in 1971, directed by Ken Russell. I am your main host, Jamie, and this is my partner, Duncan, my subordinate.
Wow, not sure about that, but you know what, I'll take it.
If I say it enough times, it will be true.
That's true. I didn't get in early there with the hello. Man, we missed the last couple of weeks, didn't we?
Did we miss 2 weeks?
2 weeks,
or
yeah.
Just one?
I had, had something apologies. Come up. But I just want to say one thing, Jamie. The boys have had my back, and I'll never forget that.
Thank you.
Deep intro to the podcast.
I assume you mean the hit Amazon Prime TV show.
Yeah, obviously. I don't mean like my friends. I mean that.
No, of course.
Exactly.
Friends.
I don't mean my
we
colleagues.
We have fun here.
I don't mean my colleagues. I just mean my. I mean the TV show. Mm. Anyway. Just wanted to say that. But what film are we watching this week, Jamie?
The Music Lovers, 1971, directed by Ken Russell. And
what is this podcast?
This podcast is where we watch films that came out 50 years ago this week, whenever this week happens to be.
Exactly.
Depending on the release date. Obviously, if you watch a 2-month-old episode, then it'll be one that came out 50 years and 2 months ago, because
that's
how time works.
Are you giving up alcohol for the next 3 days, Jamie, for the 29th,
no.
30th, and 31st of February?
For what?
Get it?
Because they don't exist?
Yeah, it's a boomer joke that I've seen on Facebook quite a lot the last few days.
I get, like, because I could never give it up.
Yeah, they were like, you know, it's like, I'm doing the 3-day no alcohol challenge, not going to drink on February the 29th, 30th, and 31st.
How wacky.
Anyway, the reason I said that is because it sets the date that this film came out on the 25th of February 1971 in the UK. It came out in the US a bit earlier. But you know what?
Yep.
Release dates.
There weren't a lot of
release dates.
Believe it or not, February is not a massive time for film releases. I had to search quite hard for this one.
I believe that. Historical context. The 25th of February 1971. Can you guess which country had its first commercial nuclear power station come online?
The UK.
No, but...
France.
No, UK was warmer.
US?
Ooh, very warm.
Canada?
That's right.
Hey,
The Pickering Nuclear Generating Station came online. And that is all the historical context I've got. I'm assuming you have.
Right, some stuff that happened this week that I wrote down. On the 21st of February, 1971, there was a convention on psychotropic substances, which, you know, I thought was relevant, given, obviously, a lot of these films are very enamoured with the old devil's lettuce, such was the time.
Yes.
On the 23rd of February, George Harrison had his licence suspended for 1 year and was fined, which reminds me of certain someone. On the 24th.
Well, that's a good that's a good
deep cut.
Good joke that all our audiences can
all enjoy. The audience will enjoy. Yeah. On the 24th, Algeria nationalized 51% of its French oil concessions. I don't know any of the background history for that, but it sounded interesting.
Nice.
On the 25th, there was the first meeting between Northern Irish Prime Minister and the Catholic Cardinal of Ireland since 1921.
Interesting.
So a bit more progress on the Troubles. Yeah. On the 27th, doctors in the first Dutch abortion clinic did an abortion.
Right.
For the first time, you know what I mean? So that's kind of interesting too. And then also on the 27th, as a little tidbit, English illusionist Derren Brown was born. So it's a cool wee birthday.
Darren Brown.
Darren Brown with an E. He does the like
have
psychology tricks. You'll definitely see him on TV.
Yes, I know him. He's 50 years old. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, because that's what this.
Yeah, happy
is.
Belated 50th birthday, Darren, from the Golden Talkies podcast.
Yeah. official friend of the podcast, Darren Byrne. So, this film, it's about Tchaikovsky, the composer.
Tchaikovsky.
Does that know what I said?
You said Tchaikovsky.
What is it?
Tchaikovsky,
got it.
Tchaikovsky.
Yeah, Tchaikovsky. It's based on a collection of his letters, allegedly.
Yes.
Which is interesting. And it's directed by Ken Russell, who actually made a lot of films about composers of this era. Something interesting that I read that I hadn't really thought about is, of course, this film came out 50 years ago, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Tchaikovsky died. Oh, yeah. Tchaikovsky died in 1893. So this film actually only came out 77 years, I think, after his death.
Oh, that is kind of interesting.
So I think nowadays we have a tendency to think of the period that this film was set as very long ago, but actually there would be people alive when this film came out that even had memories of the time when he died.
Well, I suppose it's interesting to think, in terms of, like, generations, the 1800s weren't actually that long ago, you know?
Exactly.
That's, like, your great-great-grandfather, I guess.
Yeah, but I guess my point is that in the 1970s, people's grandparents and stuff would have potentially been around at that time.
Do you know what they called the 1890s back then? I've given you this trivia on the podcast before, but I find it interesting. They were called the gay 90s.
Is that right?
Yep, which I found very interesting. I read that in a Peanuts comic from 1950, and I was like, oh yeah, there was like a time when people would have had a nickname for the 1890s because it was recent.
Exactly.
Isn't that interesting? And speaking of gay 90s,
this guy is gay.
Yes, that's the question.
By this guy, I of course mean Tchaikovsky.
Yes. And was in real life as well, obviously. But just to...
Yeah.
I didn't know that before watching this film. It was interesting.
Neither.
So, yeah, I guess the basic plot of this film is really about him struggling with that fact. And then everyone goes a bit insane by the end. And that's the movie.
That's a pretty good synopsis.
Okay, more in-depth synopsis. Now that we've done the first layer, we can go a drop deeper.
Is this going to be the whole podcast? We're going to like gradually build up until the end. We'd like talk for an hour about every single plot detail.
Yes, exactly, that's what I think. Perfect. I think we start with one sentence and then by the end we just recite the film word for word. That's how we do every episode, obviously. But so we open sort of in the early days of Tchaikovsky's career, where he's sort of not quite established a name for himself, but he's seen as a promising composer who's got a little job at the university, or no, what's it, the conservatory?
Conservatoire,
that's right.
Conservatory. That's a glass box that posh people build in the back of their house.
Second down the track. But, he's got some promise, but, you know, he's not it yet.
No.
And there's rumours about his scandalous private life, where we see that he is in a casual relationship with a count who is obviously a man, and that is the whole issue.
But Count Anton.
Thank you. I will not remember anyone's name other than Tchaikovsky's throughout this entire film. And even then, I can't pronounce it consistently, so that's great.
There you go, after correcting me.
But, he premieres a new tune he's written. And he thinks it's fantastic. All the audience are mesmerized by it. We see lots of weird little fantasies they're all having as they enjoy the music.
Women particularly.
Yes, women in particular.
The women love him. And they have these little dream sequences about him while the music plays, which I'm sure we'll come on to later. But
But when he's done, the sort of head guy of the conservatoire says that it's shit, mate. Which I think is, looking up Tchaikovsky, there's the whole thing that he wasn't following the Russian classical tradition in his music and was leaning more towards Western styling, so he was a bloody sellout.
I think he was one of the the first Russian composers to be sort of internationally liked and recognized and stuff. So
yeah, that makes sense. Diluting his soul. I'm sure Tchaikovsky was honest to himself, but you know, there's some hostility about him betraying national values that were at the time. So Tchaikovsky's a bit upset about this, and he says he won't change a single note, and he screams it with horrible, horrible screams, which we'll hear a lot more of as we go through the film. One audience member at this recital was a random woman whose name I've forgotten, but Duncan, you sounded like you've written characters' names down.
Antonina. I think she's referred to as Nina for the film.
Yes, she's referred to as Nina throughout the film. And we see her having a fantasy about Tchaikovsky, which, you know, just a little sexual thing. And she starts writing him letters. She seems to be in a horrible, abusive relationship with a man from the military, an officer type, and wants to get out of there and into the high society. Although it does seem that she does genuinely, you know, she is genuinely infatuated with Tchaikovsky. It's not a calculated, it's calculated, but it's based on a real feeling. That's probably the balance.
Exactly.
So Tchaikovsky's, you know, everyone's remarkably cool with what they know about him, but they're still being very mean. And the head of the conservatoire says that, you know, oh, if you didn't have that sort of control over your private life, it's no wonder your music's shit, mate. Tchaikovsky's sort of writing a new opera about sort of people who fall in love with letters, and now these love letters are arriving, and obviously he's looking for a way to deny his true nature. He sort of becomes not sort of emotionally or spiritually attracted to Nina, which is, I think, the word the film uses is spiritual, and it's quite careful to keep that line in place. So they start writing to each other and have a lovely old time, and they eventually get married, but very hurriedly. Only after they get engaged with their first in-person meeting, and it's very clearly not a considered decision,
as you do in the 1800s.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the sort of thing, like, it seems very hard to me, but then there's always like pie in my eyes, like, was that normal? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know if it was normal, but I definitely think it was a lot more common.
Yeah, that's true. Also, other important person who was at the recital is his eventual patron, who's a wealthy widow, and she wants to give him money so that he can create his wonderful music. No one understands him but her. He's a genius. But she's very insistent that they should never meet. That's her thing. She wants to keep distance from him. But they write to each other, and they become friends through this exchange of letters. So we get to the honeymoon with Nina, and already there are really big problems. We see their first night together, and understandably Tchaikovsky can't, you know, get it up, and he's very embarrassed about this. And Nina's sort of understanding, but you can already tell that this is an issue. And he says maybe they should live as brother and sister for a while until he's ready.
Which she's not very happy with, because, of course, she's been looking forward to getting boned by Tchaikovsky.
Yeah. Then they go see Swan Lake, which is obviously a Tchaikovsky thing. A very good one, you know. Not to throw hot takes around here, but Swan Lake, all right, solid 7 out of 10. I'd give that one a stream.
Nice. And Count Anton turns up, and explains
Count Anton,
the plot.
Count Anton very understandably was very against the marriage and said that Tchaikovsky was in denial. But yeah, so we find that Nina doesn't really understand Swan Lake, but Anton's happy to slightly patronizingly explain it to her,
very much imply that it is. He tells the plot in such a way that it makes her query her marriage, I guess.
Yes, he's using it as an opportunity to sow seeds of doubt.
Exactly.
So they keep arguing throughout the marriage. They sort of realize neither, sorry, throughout the honeymoon, they realize neither of them have anything in common. And then they get a train back to Moscow, and then there's a really horrifying sort of creepy scene, not creepy, stressful scene,
yeah,
where they try to have sex again, and it's sort of showing how deeply, deeply upsetting this is to Tchaikovsky, in a very sort of claustrophobic way. Claustrophobic is the best adjective.
Yeah, that scene was pretty incredible.
Yeah, that was the best scene in the thing, I think.
Yeah,
this film,
I would say so.
This film has peaks and valleys, so it does.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Let's finish the plot.
Yes. I'm going to be honest. I began to lose track of what was happening after a while, so there are going to be big blank spots here. But
right.
They get back to Moscow, pressures in their marriage continue, Nina's mother comes to stay, and
yeah,
she sort of inadvertently exacerbates them because Nina doesn't like her mother at all.
And
her mother never believed.
Well, she comes to stay with them, and they don't have a second bedroom, so Tchaikovsky says that his wife and her mum can sleep in the same bed, and he'll sleep on the sofa, which is obviously a ploy on his part.
To
at least
get
a little bit.
Distance.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, the mother, Nina doesn't like the mother, so they never got along. The mother never believed that she could snag a high-class man. Nina is getting very stressed about the fact that she's losing control over Tchaikovsky and affection, so she starts trying to see men to make him jealous. Tchaikovsky, on the other hand, is really worried because he's lost his inspiration and divine spark, and he's unable to write anything. And this also worries his wealthy patron, who starts subtly trying to sabotage the marriage by sending people to, you know, get in the way.
Yeah.
So this tension sort of exists for a little bit, and then everyone goes bonkers. Tchaikovsky tries to strangle Nina in a moment of rage, not over jealousy, but just, you know, her smothering him and ruining his life. So in the wake of that, his patron asks him to come stay with her, not in the same house, because obviously she wants to keep apart from him, but just not because of danger, but because of the spiritual connection from before. But he can go there and he can write, and Nina will stay in Moscow, and he'll send her an allowance so she has something to live on.
Yeah.
And then this is maybe where you can begin to fill in some of the blanks for me, Duncan. Nina goes insane because she's unable to win Tchaikovsky back at all. And she, stuff happens.
She gets institutionalized.
Yes, she gets institutionalized, and then by the end of the film, she's on the streets of Moscow, letting random beggar people feel her up to feel.
No, no, that's still in the asylum.
Oh, that's still no, because her mother runs into her.
No,
I'm talking about the very last scene for her in the Great. Oh, in the asylum. Okay. Well, regardless, it's not going well for her by the end.
No.
And she screams a lot. There's a lot of shouting about how people do love her and she is lovable. Tchaikovsky, for his part, there's a party and Anton comes along. The party's in Tchaikovsky's honor, and then something happens at the party and I didn't catch it, so could you tell me what it was, Duncan, that made the patron leave?
Is this the one where he sees the woman in the bath?
That's ages. That's the beginning. That's his mother, right? His mother died of cholera.
Yeah, I think we missed that right at the start. He's at a party. Well, his mother died of cholera, and the last treatment that they tried to give her was putting her in a boiling bath. And he sees her as a child in this bath, and he sees her die. So then he's at a party, and he doesn't want to be at the party. He wants to be working. But Anton convinces him to come out, and then he hears a woman singing in the bath. He goes in, he has a flashback. He thinks it's his mother. He tries to rescue her. Everyone else thinks he's trying to rape her, and then that's all sorted out, but that like sets the scene for later on in the film.
Yeah, I'm talking about the final party in the patron's garden with the fireworks, and then there's a big fire. And then because of that, the patron withdraws her support, and I didn't catch why.
But he meets her, doesn't he?
He goes into the house so that they can feel as though they've been in the same room. I remember that.
Right.
Is that just the reason that he meets her and then she withdraws support? Like it's ruined?
I don't know.
Cool. Right, neither of us.
But this
got
is
that.
Yeah, we skipped over this bit because there's another fantasy sequence as well before his wife gets put in an asylum. There's the sequence of the 1812 overture where he
yes,
people
that's
are firing
the final.
At him
well, that's after the patron drops her support.
Yes,
and then he.
But it's before his it's before his
upset.
Wife goes to.
Yes,
asylum.
So the 1812 overture is a fantasy sequence where he imagines blowing off every named character's head with the cannons, famously in that piece. And then Tchaikovsky, whose life is ruined, drinks water with cholera in it so that he will die of suicide. And then they say, "Doctor, oh, this is too embarrassing. You should make it. You should write down that he died of cholera," and that's what makes the film historically accurate. Because obviously that's exactly what happened, and he didn't just die of cholera. That would be ridiculous.
Well, the film implies that he actually died by being boiled in a bath, the same as his mum, which is not what happened.
Yeah.
Right.
The film does not seem the most concerned with historical accuracy.
No. There's a lot of metaphors and stuff that. Although I think it's historically accurate in terms of the base story of his life and the letters and stuff. But then I just think I think it's got a lot of focus on metaphors and fantasy and stuff as well.
Yeah. He also had a successful marriage, which I think is important and not mentioned.
Did he?
By the film.
Oh.
Yeah.
We have clearly missed a bit. Both of us.
Well, have we? The thing is, right, this film, I think it's important now, because the essence of this film cannot be captured in recapping the plot, because the essence of this film is being melodramatic as fuck. And that means that not a lot actually happens, but there's an awful lot of people screaming about it, and running around, and yelling, and crying, and shouting. And it, you know, I'm a big melodrama fan. I have said so on this podcast in the past, and I'm going to lay down my opinion card here and say that I thought it was a bit much. The melodrama dials sort of crank to 11 throughout the entirety of the second half, and it just gets a bit boring after a while.
I kind of agree, but I also, I think there's a big focus on. Like fantasy sequences and flashbacks and dream sequences and stuff, and I think he kind of gets away with the melodrama a bit because you never really know quite what's real or not towards the end.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, they do cut to fantasy sequences without establishing them, but I was always fairly sure when we were in reality. It was always just... Well, there was a lot of, like, points where I was confused. Like, are we in a fantasy sequence now? Oh, yeah, I guess we must be, you know what I mean? So...
Right.
I mean, maybe it's part of an intentional effect, or maybe even if it wasn't intentional, works in the film's favour, I would say that it really just sort of muddles it. I wouldn't necessarily say it would be better to have clear delineations between fantasy and reality, because that's not my bag, son. But
no.
Maybe... work harder to combine them or whatever.
Yeah,
I do. But yeah, I don't know. The thing I suppose for the melodrama, and maybe I would relate to it differently if I were a queer person, but maybe I wouldn't, is that I don't really relate to any of the characters' emotions, and therefore it's quite hard to invest in the struggle, if you know what I mean. Like, I like melodrama when it's like a heightened version of what you as the audience are feeling, but I suppose because all of the characters' problems are things that would only exist historically and are often of their own making, it's a little hard to invest in them, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Because I don't know, like, even, obviously Tchaikovsky's suffering as a gay person in a homophobic society, but also he did create the situation entirely by himself and completely has the power to end it quite easily.
What's the marriage and stuff?
Yeah, the marriage. I mean, that's the problem. He seems quite happy beforehand, even if he was, you know, being...
Yeah, but, I mean, don't you think the point is that there's societal pressure on him to marry? Because
I mean, maybe that's the point, but I don't think it's really illustrated very well. I think it's
I think it kind of is. Or maybe it's not societal. He thinks that he can fix himself.
Yes,
he thinks that he's broken and that he can fix himself. But I don't think that's his problem. Mm-hmm. I think that's supposed to be the society's problem. In terms
yes, that's
of,
true. But I suppose the absolute fury of his emotion is based off, I would say, guilt, mostly over what he's done to Nina.
Yes.
And it's just, I don't think the film quite justifies that, because Nina's come quite well out of the deal in a way.
Nina has.
Yeah, as well, sort of, you know what
she's
I mean?
She's in an asylum, Jamie.
Yeah, but that's towards the end. The melodrama starts way before that.
Yeah, but
I'm not saying by the end she's in a better place. I'm saying once, look, the melodrama point starts halfway through the film, where he and Nina are in an unhappy marriage, but a fairly successful one to the outside observer.
Yeah, but everything she wants is love and sex.
She wants to be loved.
He can't give her either of those, so...
I realise really that, but I feel place. That these are sort of quieter emotions, if you know what I mean.
Quieter emotions? She throws herself on the floor of the train while the lights flash and the train's shaking and she wants nothing more than sex, Jamie.
Look, I get Nina's thing, it's still very over the top. But Tchaikovsky, I just don't... Look, this film fucking is... a runaway train of emotion, and I just don't think the pieces are really in place to light that particular explosion, to mix my metaphors. Do you know what? I'm just saying that, I don't think I've ever seen a film, ever, in my entire life, which had this much emotion consistently all the time.
Mm.
And I don't think the pieces are really laid in place for it to sell that. And it just comes off looking a bit silly. Towards the end, Nina, has probably got... Well, I mean, all the characters have suffered, but Nina, by the end, has obviously suffered massively. But then there's that scene in the insane asylum where she screams, and then she just sort of weirdly, awkwardly runs from one wall to the other, like that fucking go test in PE. And, it just seems silly.
But she's insane, Jamie.
I know she's insane, but... Maybe she shouldn't be. Maybe she should be insane a little quieter so that I can take the scene seriously.
Jimmy, we're gonna get cancelled.
People don't go insane in real life because they get upset, Duncan. This film is not an accurate representation of mental health. I will happily put my foot down on that. I will happily risk it, even if though I lack qualifications. I do not believe that one can get sectioned because of existential despair.
I'm sorry, guys. This is the last episode of the Golden Talkies podcast. By next week, we will put out our apology video, and we'll have moved on with our lives. It's been a good run, but I'm afraid.
I appreciate that both Nina and Tchaikovsky would be deeply emotionally distraught at the situation that they both find themselves in. But even that, I don't think. There is any situation in the entire world that could justify the level of melodrama that goes on in the second half of this film.
But what if the film's just... Why is the film not allowed to be a bit melodramatic, Jamie?
It's not a bit melodramatic, is the issue.
Why is that not allowed?
I'm not saying it's not allowed. I'm just saying I thought it...
Why does every film have to be some, realist thing? What's your problem, man?
Fucking anime, man. I'm not insisting that everything has to be realistic or non-melodramatic. I like melodrama. But it's silly in this. It's too silly to take seriously, and it's too serious to have fun with. So it just feels like a bit of an awkward time as you watch really unhappy people scream constantly in a just. It's just I'm not involved, so I don't find it emotionally interesting. And when you don't find a melodrama emotionally interesting, then you're just sort of sitting there awkwardly in the room whilst people have a breakdown, and that's not fun or interesting.
Do you know what's the most watched programme on British TV ever, Jamie?
EastEnders?
EastEnders, right?
I will happily say that EastEnders melodrama is better than this.
People love melodrama and people shouting and...
small emotional situations getting blown
up. But there's
up.
Good melodrama, and there's bad melodrama, and this
so
is
you
bad
think,
melodrama.
You think EastEnders... You're saying right now EastEnders is better than The Music Lovers?
Yes.
Okay.
Instant. I didn't even have to hesitate to think about it. Yes.
Okay.
Cool. EastEnders gets it. EastEnders understands how melodrama works. It's been on the air for 50 bloody years or whatever. Like, it knows... Because you need to carefully lay the path before you can do melodrama properly, you know?
Like, is it... wait, is EastEnders on every single fucking day? Except Wednesday?
I think so.
Every weekday? Holy fuck.
Yeah, it's a soap.
What the hell? How long? Are they not like an hour each as well? Or is it half an hour?
I think it's half an hour.
I thought it was like once a week or maybe twice a week.
No, you have to tune in
it's
every day.
Fucking every day. Are the other ones the same? Like
most soaps are like that. Coronation Street, definitely.
Man,
imagine
working on one of those.
Well,
someone's died from Coronation Street. Johnny Briggs died an hour ago.
I'm sorry for Johnny Briggs.
Rest in peace.
The point I'm making is that melodrama works on soaps because they spend so much time building up to these things because they have to because they're on every bloody day. Like, you know, I don't know any... If Ian Beale has a breakdown on EastEnders, then that will have been built up for, like, 2 weeks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
well,
whereas...
It's funny you say that because I think I found this film very boring in the first half and I only got at all interested when the crazy shit started happening.
I found the entire film incredibly boring. I think it was one of the hardest films to watch that we've done. Had I been watching it alone, I would have turned it off in the first 10 minutes.
But do you know what I do agree with? That it has very much has highs and lows. I do think it has some extraordinary scenes.
I think it is bad in a moderately interesting way, but only in very small parts.
So. My favourite scene, the scene on a train was incredible. Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
The 1812 overture scene was incredible.
Mm.
And the institution scene was pretty alright.
Okay, well, I've made my opinions on that scene clear.
So, other than that, it's pretty boring.
Yes.
That's my
Plus
my
the
opinion.
Other thing, it's really boring as well.
Yeah.
Look, okay. I'm putting my thoughts together more. There needs to be a build up to a melodrama. There needs to be tension that can be released through melodrama.
I think there
understand?
Is though.
There needs to be a rising fall in action, and there just isn't that there.
I think there is.
It's just,
I don't
least,
think that's why.
The release is too long for what was
okay.
there.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that definitely. It's. I don't really know what else to say about it. It's. I clearly don't hate it as much as you, but I do want to make it clear that I don't like it. But I do think it has some very good scenes. Do you know what the 1812 overture scene reminded me a lot of the scene from I, Clowns? Do you remember that one?
Which one?
The finale of Fellini's clown film, where like everything's just going mental.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it, but I think I'm not so much got a problem with the melodrama, but I do think some of the fantasy scenes and crazy scenes could have done with the rest of the film not being so dull. And I don't.
Yeah.
It's a hard balance because I think I think you do need to balance out. Unless you are just making a film that's batshit insane, you do have to balance out the like dream sequences and the fantasy scenes with realism. But I think there's a right way to do it, and I'm not sure if this film does it. And I think it's very hard to do, because even great films... I did a whole course last year on dream films and films that have dream sequences in them. And I'm not sure if I really liked any of them, because the... dream sequences are often so much better and more interesting than the rest of the film, and I think it's really hard to try and balance them out, because if you are presenting them as dreams and fantasies, then the rest of the film really does just have to be completely real, and that's pretty boring, I think. And you end up with a film like this that has like incredible highs, but also just really dull sequences. Like, I'm thinking about Fellini, 8.5 particularly. I remember the only scenes I remember that are dream sequences, which are really cool, but the rest of it's just really boring. He's just talking to people and driving around and stuff. So I think that's a tough one to pull off properly.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know, like, so the thing is, I like the 1812 scene in isolation.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Bit, yeah.
But due to the problems I've covered extensively at this point, so I won't repeat them. Like, it does feel just a bit out of place. Yes, I feel it would have been much better in a film that had built up to it better. I don't know. I'm thinking the example I have in my head right now of, I'm not sure if it even counts as a melodrama, but the sort of thing that I would be looking for is The Favourite. Because that film has a lot of melodramatic points, but it spends so much time investing in tension. And I really think that's what you need. Because melodrama to me is sort of much like, I don't know, a gunfight or something. Like, it's entirely about releasing tension that you've built up. And if you haven't built it up properly, then there's nothing there, and it feels strange and awkward. Because the audience has to sympathize with that tension of emotion. If the character is feeling much more intensely about it than you, like, there's a massive disparity, then it doesn't work. Whereas in EastEnders, when you're deeply invested in these characters because you've watched them every day of your life for 30 years, then it works.
I couldn't really hear you there.
I was saying in EastEnders it works because you've watched these characters every day of your life for 30 years, so you're really invested in them.
That's true. Okay, you're back now. I can hear you again.
Yeah.
Thank God. I thought we were going to have another audio issue.
So did I, my friend.
Alongside these scenes being good, I thought the cinematography overall was pretty good. Which prompted me to look up the cinematographer, because normally we only talk about the director and the cast, but
we do auteur theory on this podcast, not because we believe in it, but because we're lazy and don't like to look up.
Because we're lazy, but I looked up the cinematographer. Oh shit! I didn't get his name though. Let me.
Wow.
I just wrote down stuff about him. Douglas Slocum. Okay.
Yeah.
So, he. Interestingly, he was in Poland when the Germans invaded. He's not Polish, he's British, but he was in Poland when the Germans invaded. So he captured that on camera, and then he managed to get home before it was like, before he properly got, he escaped on a train. He was commissioned by someone to film a Goebbels rally and the burning of a synagogue. And then he finally got home. So then, after he captured those, when he got home, he worked at Ealing Studios for a while. Okay. And then he filmed The Italian Job.
Cool.
Right? Yeah. Then he filmed this film.
Yeah.
And then, do you want to know what his biggest work is?
What was his biggest work?
What?
What was his biggest
work?
The
first three Indiana Jones films. The first three Indiana Jones films.
The good ones. Interesting.
So, yeah. So this guy clearly is a pretty good cinematographer.
Yeah, that's surprising.
He's not won any Oscars, but he got nominated for a few, and he's won a couple of BAFTAs and stuff. So, yeah, the cinematography was pretty good, and that's because it had a very good cinematographer doing it.
Congrats to that guy. And,
yep. He died age 103 as well.
Christ.
Pretty old.
Yeah.
Anyway. that's cool, right?
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting fact. Well done.
Thank you.
I'll give you a treat later.
Have you got anything else to say about the film?
About the film? Not really.
No, I
thought the actors did the best with what they were given. I don't think it was their fault.
Yeah. Do you know any of the actors? Any of their other...
The main guy looks really familiar.
Richard Chamberlain. He was in... Richard Chamberlain. Apparently there was a 1988... Oh, wait. Am I being dumb? One second. Before I say this, I want to check if I'm being dumb. No, I'm not being dumb. Okay, there was a 1988 Bourne Identity, which he was in before the 2002 one, which had the same plot, it seemed to. So he was in that, so that's cool. And he was in a bunch of other films that, like, I recognised as being films that I know but haven't seen. Richard Chamberlain is his name.
Yeah.
He was in The Towering Inferno that I've heard of, The Three Musketeers that I don't think I've seen, Julius Caesar, so... Mm-hmm. He was in I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which I've also not seen.
Ah, oh, the greatest. Actually, let's use Chuck and Larry as the leaping off point for the last point I wanted to make.
Right.
Which is that I thought that this film was probably the most sensitive depiction of homosexuality we've seen so far.
Yeah.
I think you could have mostly shown it today and people would have been fine with it. The Count Anton's a bit of a stereotype. He's a bit foppish, but, you know...
The guy that played him is a ballet dancer. Which I don't want to be stereotypical, but they are kind of known for...
He's very over-the-top camp.
Yes, I assume the guy is like that in real life, and that's probably why they hired him.
I thought, you know... Because I've talked about it before, but in performance and stuff, I think that homosexuality in a lot of the films we've seen, even ones that support it, tend to treat it as like a choice or just part of free love in general.
Yes.
But I thought this film
performance
was...
Particularly.
Yeah, but this film was, you know, it's who Tarkovsky is. Even if he wants to change it, it's not something he can. It's, you know, it's a part of him, and it's society's fault for not accepting that.
Yeah, I would
which
agree.
I thought, you know, good on Kent Russell and this film, I suppose, for that.
Who else? Getting Straight, did it have... I don't think it really had gay characters in it, it just mentioned
it. No, it just had a little casual homophobia.
Yeah, it was pretty homophobic. What other ones have you watched?
Had
it? The Vampire Lovers was about...
Oh, yeah, that was...
lesbians, but it
lesbians.
Perhaps wasn't the most progressive
representation.
Yeah.
Well, that was... that was some smoking hot lesbian action, rather than a sensitive portrayal.
I think that's
pretty
much it, isn't it?
Homosexuality in it? No, there was something else other than a film that I felt was very similar to it, sort of dual identities thing.
The statue had, you know, obviously Charlie. The main guy is obsessed with Charlie's cock, so.
Yeah, I don't know, that's going to really bother me. I'd look it up, but I've gotten complaints by a certain member of the Golden Talkies team about the sound of my trackpad when I look things up on the laptop, so I can't do it.
It is very not loud. What? Oh, no. Wow. Okay, so I was just looking at our thing, right?
Yeah.
And a month ago we did Vanishing Point, and I'd completely forgotten what Vanishing Point was about, or who was in it, or what it was. I'm not seeing anything else. Carry On Loving, did it have... I'm sure Carry On Loving had some homophobia in it. Probably.
Probably. Or at least casual sexism.
No, I'm not seeing anything else that I remember. Performance.
I'll take a look at the films and write it down. I'll mention it next week if something comes to me.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, did it have...
Oh, yeah, it did. Remember, or at least an intersex character. And I'm using a much better term than that film used.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, they were evil. So, again, not a great example, but I think that was also portraying it as a free love thing, you know, I mean, rather than a part of who people are.
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know. Points for the music lovers there is the only thing that it will get points for from me. Oh, I'm just kidding. And also the train sequence and In Isolation, the dreams.
Yes, I like the train sequence, the fantasy... 1812 sequence and a couple of the other dream sequences really were okay, but unfortunately the film as a whole let that down.
Alright,
so shall we rate it?
Yep. I'll go first because I usually do, and also because I don't think my rating will be a surprise. I'm going to say don't watch for this one.
I am going to say watch if it's on.
Okay.
I didn't hate it. It had some good sequences, but there are definitely better dream films containing dreams, such as 8 and a Half, or I don't know, lots of films.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Right then, I've got to go fairly quickly, so we won't talk about our current media tastes, which I know is everyone's favourite portion of the podcast anyway.
Wow, even though we've not done an episode for ages, and we're skipping over
the best bit. I
sections.
Know.
I've not really been.
I started watching Deep Space Nine. I don't have an opinion on it yet. I started playing Stardew Valley and Persona 5 Scramble. Enjoy opinions on those some point.
I watched a Korean film called Minari at the Glasgow Film Festival.
Oh yeah, that's quite good.
It was okay. It was. It was very like slice of life kind of film.
Hell yeah.
Which is not my favourite. I like my films to have something about them, but it was quite good. And because I watched that, and I was telling my parents I'd watched that, I then ended up watching Parasite again. My parents were watching it for the first time last night, so I watched that with them.
Can I please really ask good. What your parents thought of Parasite?
They liked it.
Okay, cool.
I'm not sure if my dad quite got the message. if I'm being honest, but do you know what? He's old, so. They liked it, but I don't know how much the message came across. He thought it was unnecessary can I spoil Parasite?
I mean, there's not much else we're going to say about you, so if you haven't seen Parasite, then don't let us spoil it for you, and just click off.
Not seen
and
Parasite,
also, congratulations on being the first person to ever watch 40 plus minutes of this podcast.
True. He thought it was unnecessary that Thingamajig killed Mr. Park. He understood why, but he thought it was a bit far.
I like that.
And actually, they had a similar opinion to you, that they didn't feel like the film had built up enough to the climax that it has, which I actually sort of agree with.
Just I want to be absolutely clear that is not my opinion on Parasite.
No,
on this film.
It's your opinion on this film. I have to slightly agree. I don't know what it is, but it just. I think the ending is really good, but the stuff that leads up to the ending is just like the best of cinema,
well,
and then the ending just feels like a good ending, I guess.
Well, what part of it? Do you mean the stabbing is not built up to properly? Because I think they put the time in.
I don't know. There's just something. It just feels a bit off. A little bit. I don't know. I like it, but I also I don't think it's perfect. But I have no idea what the perfect ending could be. I guess is what I'm saying.
Right,
like any other film, I wouldn't be complaining about it because it's an awesome ending, and it's definitely built up to, and it definitely fits in the film. But I just think like the rest of the film is absolutely perfect, and then there's just something about the ending that feels a little bit flat for me. That's I think, or doesn't quite fit in. That's my opinion on it. So I love it. I love the whole film. I love the ending, but I just think the rest of the film is such a masterpiece, and for me, the ending is just very good rather than perfect.
Okay,
that's my official Parasite opinion.
Fair enough. My official Parasite opinion is that it's pretty dang good all the way through. I also watched Ran last night. If we're going to talk about films we watched, which is Kurosawa's King Lear adaptation, and it's very, very good.
Nice.
It's a right shame that Kurosawa is mostly remembered for working in black and white, because this is a colour film, and it is easily one of the best of those I've ever seen, in terms of using colour very, very specifically.
I'm just looking at pictures from it, and it looks incredible.
It looks amazing. It's like, it's good old Technicolor, so the colours look better than real life. And like you can tell that like this is like a point where colour is sort of a novelty, so like there's a real effort to make as good a use of it as possible. So it looks fantastic. It's obviously based on a very good story, and Kurosawa has an interesting take on it with his usual critiques of samurai culture.
I definitely need to watch more Kurosawa because I'm not the biggest fan of Seven Samurai. I just find it quite long.
I like Seven Samurai, but anyone who critiques it for being long is entirely valid.
Yeah, exactly.
Pixar's A Bug's Life exists, so there's already a perfect version of that film that exists.
Yeah, so I do want to watch them. I want to watch Rashomon. Rashomon's
very good.
I'm looking now, and it's only an hour and a half, whereas
Ran's
is 2 hours 42.
Yeah, that's normal length. It's not Seven Samurai. It's
yeah, it's still
hour
an hour
buffet.
Shorter than Seven Samurai. Yeah, so yeah, I do want to watch more Kurosawa, definitely.
Yeah, he's a good boy.
He's a cool dude.
Right, shall we sign off
right.
then? I'm feeling
yep,
good.
I think so.
Cool.
Did I say
next week's Death in Venice, if we do a podcast next week?
Yeah, I mean, we probably will. Maybe. I guess we'll see.
Cool. I'm moving back next week, so we'll see if I have time.
You are.
But cool.
True. Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.